Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Aaron and Trishul continue to discuss cost basis. Aaron explains the math behind RSU and NQSO basis, and why an ISO can have two different cost basis values. Trishul examines optimal gifting strategies. They also investigate how depreciation and upgrades can affect your home's cost basis, and how the step-up in basis on death works in community property versus separate property states. As Aaron tries to remember the nuances behind discounted ESPPs, they both realize the central point of the conversation: to turn unknown unknowns into known unknowns, so that you are aware of when to be more careful. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. So last week, Trishul and I started talking about cost basis, and we kind of done our little pre-podcast list, and we had a list of quite a few things we wanted to talk about, and realized we only got to like just regular stocks in a taxable investment account. And even then, we still went longer than we expected. So we definitely had to break it into two parts. So today, we're going to try to be talking about other things related to cost basis. So cost basis part two. One of the things that kind of I was thinking of was looking at, for my clients, the RSUs and stock options. That does come up a decent amount. I think we're talking about things like home depreciation and depreciation recapture, some of the gifting. Sometimes you get dual basis stock. Trishul had one definition of dual basis stock. I actually had a different definition of dual basis stock. So Trishul, for today, is there anything else that you think we will make sure we take care of for basis as opposed to things other than buying and selling stocks in a taxable investment account?
I think that's a good laundry list for today. It's certainly a big topic, and I think if we can cover some of this stuff, it'll provide a good foundation for just having this important topic on a little bit under control.
Okay, so I think continuing on the buying stocks over time, for a lot of my clients, when it comes to stock options and RSUs, one of the big aspects is understanding how the basis is established. So I was gonna say, cut me off if I start to go too long, but I don't, knowing myself, I don't know if I can hold myself back. So with stock options, if you have a non-qualified stock option or a non-statutory stock option, you pay ordinary income taxes when you exercise. So the bargain element, just the spread between your exercise price and the fair market value at the time of exercise, is taxed at ordinary income. So if you have an option to buy a share for $1, it's currently trading at $10. When you exercise that option, you will pay taxes on $9 per share. Now, if you happen to hold on to the stock, so you can exercise and hold the stock, or you can exercise and sell the stock, because the exercise is the purchase of the stock. That fair market value at exercise determines your cost basis for those shares. So with a non-qualified stock option or non-statutory stock option, if you exercise and sell immediately, there's no gain. So you've paid ordinary income taxes on the spread, the bargain element, but there's no additional gain. But if you hold those shares, you've already paid taxes to establish your basis. Now, it behaves like normal stocks in a taxable account, where if you hold it for longer than a year, it's long-term, less than a year, short-term. You can have gain above, it can go down below that exercise price. But that fair market value at exercise is one which determines your taxes, because employee stock options you've never paid taxes on. And these are a form of employment income. So IRS says you don't have to pay taxes until you exercise, but that's why it's taxed as ordinary income. That establishes your basis. And from that point on, you can get kind of normal basis rules, normal long-term, short-term gain loss. Very rough rule of thumb is, because you already have to pay taxes on that spread, that bargain element, and they will actually withhold taxes for you. So they're going to automatically sell some shares at no gain to cover the taxes for the exercise. A lot of times it makes sense to wait until you're ready to sell before you exercise NSOs. Again, it's a very rough rule of thumb. Could be different for other people, but that's a rough guide. For ISOs, if you follow all the ISO rules, and we had a whole other podcast episode on ISOs, but the spread, the bargain element, if you hold the shares longer than a year from exercise and 2 years from grant date, then that entire bargain element can be taxed at long-term capital gains. So with ISOs, there's no withholding requirements. And if you meet so there's no tax withholding requirements at exercise. And if you meet the time holding requirements, then you can get that entire value from exercise to sale price as long-term capital gains. The caveat is that bargain element, that spread between exercise price and fair market value at exercise, is an AMT preference item. So for your regular calculation, if you exercise ISOs, hold them for at least a year, and you get all the good ISO benefits, you actually have two bases to track. Because for regular tax calculations, your basis is your exercise price. So it's that very low one, and the entire amount above that is gain. For AMT purposes, because you've already included that bargain element in your AMT calculation for that year, your AMT basis is fair market value at exercise, just like the NSOs. So when it comes to ISOs, you actually have to track two separate cost bases, so that when you sell in the future, you have to do the AMT calculation accounting for your gain or loss relative to your AMT basis, and you do your regular calculation relative to your gain or loss on the regular side, which is just the exercise price. So ISOs, much more complex. That's my definition of dual basis stock, is the regular calculation versus the AMT basis when it pertains to ISOs. And the last one I deal with is restricted stock units, RSUs. So now you don't get to decide when to pay the taxes. The RSU, you pay the taxes at the vesting schedule. So as each lot, going back to our conversation from last week, as each lot of RSUs vests, you owe ordinary income taxes on the amount of shares vesting at that time. So if you're vesting on a quarterly basis and it's vesting over 3 or 4 years, however many shares vest this quarter, likely get sold to cover the taxes, because you do have tax withholding requirements, but that also establishes your basis for any of the RSUs that you're going to hold. And technically, it's restricted stock units are unvested. As soon as they vest, they convert to shares of stock in that company if you were to hold them. So that would also be establishing your basis on the date they vest. So your basis is the value and the at vest at on, and the date that they vest. So that establishes that short-term, long-term. So RSUs and non-qualified stock options are very similar after you exercise NSOs and after RSUs vest. They are functionally the same. You could sell immediately and you owe no gain because all the taxes owed are based on either vesting or exercise and also mostly ordinary income. But after that, it's all, if you hold it for longer than a year, you get long-term capital gains, sell it less than a year, short-term capital gains. If it goes up, you have a gain. If it goes down, you have a loss. So with RSUs, it's the vesting date determines the cost basis for any shares you hold from vesting RSUs. So I think I took up most of our time today just talking about how I help my clients. And this is actually why I asked to see their 1099s, to make sure that the basis is getting reported correctly for these types of transactions. So again, that's, I think, equity compensation, stock options, RSUs, that's a we've talked about in the past, but that's a much more complex conversation. For you, what are some other ways, other than stocks in a taxable account, taxable investment account, that you look at basis or cost basis? And I'll try and drink some water and catch my breath.
Well, I really appreciate the in-depth background on that. You know, frankly, when it came to stock options, that was one of the big decisions I had to make on my end when I was thinking about exercising the stock options that I was granted when I was working back at the hedge fund. And it was a very big question because of this whole notion of basis. And I knew that it could have a pretty big impact. The situation for myself was a little different, where I had non-qualified stock options, but it was for a private company. So the big concern there is, if I went ahead and I exercised, well, yeah, I would have to report income on the current fair market value at the time that I exercised, but also I couldn't sell those positions. So I would kind of be stuck holding on to something that may not have a liquidity option for a very long time. So that's a big part of why that decision was so tough for myself. I realized that if I did exercise early, well, I would keep my basis pretty low. And then from that point onward, it would be long-term capital gains if I held on to that position for many years, which would be great. But I wouldn't be able to sell that position if I needed to or if I wanted to. Whereas on the flip side, I didn't need to exercise. I could have waited until the options were about to expire, you know, maybe 10 years down the road. I think that was the time horizon they gave me from the date that they were granted. So I could have waited many, many years until there was the opportunity to maybe sell and then exercise. But at that point, if I exercised, you know, many years from that point on, well, then my basis would have been much higher and it would have been as if I was recording income on that exercise price that, again, is far higher than if I had exercised when the price was much lower. And that made a big mathematical difference on my spreadsheet. I realized, you know, it was the difference between a couple hundred thousand in gains that I would have to pay taxes on at ordinary rates versus long-term capital gains rates. So, you know, a small decision like that can make a pretty big difference. So I certainly took that decision to heart.
Yeah, that's, again, same thing like we mentioned last time, that spectrum between investment risk and optimal taxes, then it sounds like you leaned towards the optimal tax strategy, but all the money and the taxes you paid to exercise was a huge investment risk. It wasn't just the exercise cost. It was the taxes that you paid as well. You realistically could never have received a payoff from that. And so it kind of, you took on a lot of investment risk and it happened to work out for you. But kind of that's why that decision is so difficult.
Well, it worked out for many reasons, but part of it is we had a 409A valuation done to lower the price that the fair market value to what we thought was sensible at the time that I exercised. So that can lower the tax burden involved. And then my actual strike price was, you know, like a penny was a founder share. So that part was a non-issue.
It's usually not the for those early private companies, it's not the exercise cost, it's the taxes associated with that. And so kind of going from a penny to $10 per share on 10,000 shares, that starts to add to your taxable income that year quite a bit. Same thing happens with ISOs. Kind of, may not, even the exercise isn't taxable under the regular calculation. Adding to that AMT, if you can't sell the shares to pay that AMT bill, that can get pretty painful. And so there've actually been phrases, sometimes ISOs, especially unvested ISOs in a private company, can feel like golden handcuffs, where you can kind of only wait and stay at the company to see if they go public, because if you leave the company, you may lose ISOs, even if they're vested. Again, there's other rules and it's company specific, but trying to make that decision with stock options in a private company is very difficult, to say the least. So what are some other things?
It was a similar issue.
So what are some other things you think about when you think of cost basis?
Well, it also comes up when you're gifting. So there's two main types of gifting. One, you're gifting to a charity, and two, you're gifting to your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And both of these have different implications to kind of think about. So let's say you're just gifting to your neighbor and you give them, you know, one share of IBM. Well, in that case, it's $100. So you want to gift that over, and that cost basis actually takes a little walk to your neighbor. So now your neighbor would inherit that cost basis. Now let's say the current price is still $100 and the neighbor sells it at $100. Well, then everybody walks away kind of clean. There's no harm nor foul in terms of taxes.
We're ignoring estate and gift taxes in this scenario.
Yeah, it's only one share.
Only focus on the capital gains and or income taxes.
Right. We'll talk about the nuances of larger donations or gifts. But for the base case, we're just talking about $100. Mm-hmm. And let's say in this case, by some stroke of magic, IBM goes to $110. Well, at that point, let's say the gift happened when IBM was at $110, and the person who received the shares, the neighbor, sells it at $120. Well, now the taxes that the neighbor pays is based upon the original cost basis of $100. And the same thing is true if the price falls from, goes from 100 to 110, but then falls back down to 100. Well, now the cost is still transfers over, and you kind of wash your hands again of taxes. However, there's something a little tricky that goes on. If I buy IBM for 100, it drops to 80 and I gift that to the neighbor. And the trickiness comes into play because it actually depends on the price that the neighbor sells IBM for that determines the cost basis, which is kind of a bit hairy. Known as a dual basis rule, or another dual basis rule beyond the one that Aaron mentioned. That might be our title for the episode.
Two types, the dual basis?
or the other basis rule beyond the one Aaron mentioned. In this situation, let's say that the neighbor has this one share, and they acquired the share when the price was 80, but the neighbor knows that I purchased it for 100. Well, in fact, if the neighbor sells the share at, let's say, 70, the cost basis is actually not the original $100, but it's 80. So you lose out on that 20. So that's something to keep in mind. That's how the rules work. And the interesting part is if the price is between 20 and 80, well, then actually there's no gain or loss reported
between 80 and 20.
80 and 100, sorry. Yeah,
it's okay.
If the price is between 80 and 100, meaning the price difference between the original purchase price and the price that the share was transferred to the neighbor, well, there is actually no tax event in that situation. So there are these slight nuances if you end up transferring a share at a loss that may not be optimal. So that's something to think about if you're gifting a share to a non-charity entity like your neighbor.
Mm-hmm. And what about the gifting to a charity?
Well, okay, so here's an interesting notion on, let's say, again, this time I have, instead of IBM, I have one share of Apple, which I bought at 100. Well, you know, today it's worth $1 million. So let's say I gift that $1 million to charity. Well, if I had sold that share of Apple for $1 million, I would owe taxes on $1 million minus 100. However, and then I could only gift, you know, whatever is left over based mm-hmm. upon a pretty high long-term capital gains rate of 23 to 24%.
That's just federal. So, if you're in California, you're paying another 10 to 12% on top of that.
Right. So you're close to $1 million is cut down by a couple hundred thousand
mm-hmm.
when the charity that receives this money is going to be less happy than if they receive $1 million. However, what you could do is you could gift those actual shares and send that over. And now the charity gets the full $1 million and you get to write off $1 million.
So you get the full credit for donating $1 million, however that applies to your individual taxes. And because it is a charity, in this case, it has to be a 501c3 charity, a qualified charity, they don't pay the capital gains taxes on that sale.
Right. So the 501c is a special class of charities that allows this ability of transfer so that you can each take advantage of the benefits associated with them.
Okay. So if you're planning to donate to charity, you probably want to donate highly appreciated stock. But if the stock is down, you probably want to sell it yourself, capture the loss, and then donate the cash to the charity.
Right. So that this begs a few different scenarios. And the notion is, if you're going to be gifting to charity anyway, well, look for stocks that are highly appreciated, that have a low cost basis.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have any of those, but you still just have stock to send over, well, look for a stock that's a loss, but go ahead and sell those stocks at a loss, book the losses, and then take those funds and then donate them.
Okay. I like that. What is one of the things we think about when you think of the basis? I know, like talking about your home price and depreciation, you want to help educate me on depreciation and depreciation recapture?
Yeah, happy to dig into that. So the notion is, let's say you buy a house for $100,000. And what you're able to do is you put like 20% down, maybe, and there's $80,000 there that slowly gets paid off over the course of the, call it, 30-year mortgage. But also over roughly 30 years, I believe it's like 27 and a half-ish,
yeah,
you would be depreciating that that home value, not the land value, but the value associated with the home itself over that period, such that you would be taking a deduction each year for depreciation. And those deductions each year for depreciation, you know, provide you with a tax benefit year after year. However, when you go to sell the house, those deductions that you ended up taking, they actually ended up increasing your cost basis over time, such that when you go to sell the house, if you end up depreciating everything away, then you actually may not have much of an amount left on your basis.
That they decrease your basis.
Sorry, decrease your basis over time.
Yeah,
increase your gain over time. Yeah. So you're slowly chipping away at your basis by having this depreciation benefit. So it's not like you get a double benefit. You're just accelerating your benefit with the depreciation.
Yeah. It's so one, if you look at your property taxes, they try to separate land value versus additions to the land. It's usually the building itself. The IRS kind of this, it's more like decisions by Congress, I guess, in this case of where the original home depreciation deduction came from. But they acknowledge it just like the materials in the house degrade over time, and you have ongoing maintenance to maintain the house to your current living standard. So they're trying to make a guess that the building itself will last 27 and a half years before you have to kind of replace enough parts where you've kind of paid the cost of the building again. And so to make up for the cost of maintenance, Congress and IRS enforces this, says, okay, you can deduct the kind of cost of that estimated maintenance. And so they've been trying to distinguish, like, there's just too many ways to play around with it, different states and different ways to say, okay, I paid this much in maintenance. So they just said everyone who owns a single family home gets a 27 and a half year depreciation of the value of the building. And this is actually part of the appraisal when you buy your house. And they actually, depending on the type of building and its use, and even other items, there are specifically identified depreciation schedules for all of these different types of units. So a multifamily home, a commercial building, even some like industrial equipment used by a business, they all have specifically identified depreciation schedules. The other thing that comes out, like if you're doing this kind of maintenance, the other idea is the upgrades, that if you put in $50,000 or $100,000 to improve the house, if you keep your receipts, that would actually be show to increase your basis. You've improved the quality of the building structure on the same amount of land. And so that will increase your basis when you eventually sell. And so most of the time, it's some combination of you've been depreciating your home value, again, that the building value over that schedule. And so you're, again, it's not lowering your basis per se. Realistically, that's how it feels. It's considered a depreciation recapture. Technically, your basis stays the same, but the sale recaptures any depreciation you've taken, but functionally works like as if your basis was lowering. Again, coming back to last week, it's kind of like your basis and your adjusted basis kind of thing. But now, so you recapture the depreciation, but your basis does go up based on those upgrades you've made. And there's actually certain rules about what qualifies as an upgrade versus what qualifies as maintenance. So, like, I think replacing the roof is a maintenance item, but a kitchen remodel can be an upgrade. So, kind of, this is why every contract kind of tell you keep your receipts. Every CPA says make sure you keep your receipts so that you can, if you're audited, know my basis increased because of the work that we did on the house, and so when we eventually sell, we have a smaller gain than just what we originally paid for it.
Yeah, certainly makes sense to keep track of all these little things, because they'll make a difference when you finally go to sell.
Anything else you can, I don't, what do you think of next when you think of cost basis and adjustments to cost basis?
Well, we should probably give honorable mention to the step up in basis, and that's kind of what started this whole conversation.
go ahead.
So the step up in basis is just the notion that, well, hopefully now it'll make a lot more sense now that we've kind of almost beat this dead horse. But that, okay, so now the notion is, let's say you buy this one share of Apple for $100 and it's worth close to $1 million. And, you know, right before you die, you know, you get a fortune cookie saying you're going to die tomorrow. And you think, okay, why not? Let me sell Apple. And you do. Well, now you owe taxes on all of these gains. And in your estate, it says, you know, your estate goes to your heirs. So that's what happens with whatever is left over from those proceeds. However, after receiving that fortune cookie, you realize that, you know, you heard an episode on what to do in these situations with your share of Apple. You hold on to that share of Apple and you don't sell it the day before you pass away. And that one share actually gets transferred to your heirs after your death because it becomes part of your estate after you pass away. Well, what happens is those gains, close to $1 million on that one share of Apple, gets reset to $1 million, whatever that price is on the day that the estate passes over to your heirs. Now that's the quick and dirty. There's a little bit more nuances, but that's the main concept of the step up in basis. The basis for your stocks, your property, your items that pass to your heirs will get stepped up to the current price when the transfer occurs. Now, there's two main times when this basis gets transferred. The first step up likely happens when it goes from yourself to your spouse. And then the second step up likely happens when it goes from, you know, the surviving spouse to the heirs after that. So those are two different scenarios. We did talk about this at length in the estate planning episode itself. But the high level notion is you have the opportunity for two separate steps up. And there is some nuances depending on which state you live in. If you're lucky to live in California, you get this full double step up in basis. Whereas if you're in a non-community property state, a separate property state, you may not get that full advantage depending on how that asset is titled. But I think that might be more for that actual episode where we dug into those nuances.
One thing I want to add, kind of, when it comes to that step up in basis, it can be the value at the date of death. It's also possible to do an alternate valuation date. I think that's 6 months after the date of death. So you can kind of decide after the fact which date you're going to use. That there's many other rules when it comes to estate planning. I didn't want to go into that part of it, but just make listeners aware that it exists.
That is a good one.
Yeah. So that kind of gets back to our conversation. Like that's one of the things that the Biden tax plan was looking to potentially eliminate, was that step up in basis. And so, it would apply. Okay, here's an interesting question. I don't know if you can answer it before my CPA, because it should apply to the house as well. So you get a step in basis. If a child inherits the parent's house, they get a step in basis. Do you know how depreciation factors into that? Is kind of like depreciation washed out along with any upgrades? I genuinely don't know. I'm trying to think.
I don't know. If I had to guess, it would make sense for it to, because you are effectively wiping out basis. But that's a very good question. You know, the other thing that might also be important to consider here is with a home, there is this exemption for a home, whether you're single or married, of I think it's like $250,000 or $500,000 on the gains. So that might make a big difference here, especially if your house has gains less than $250,000 or $500,000. It may be a non-issue for many, many people.
Yeah. So if you sell your primary residence, which you have to have lived there two of the last 5 years. And I think there's a phase out scheduled if you didn't live there the last 5 years. It's $250 per person, so $500,000 for a married couple. So if you bought the house for $200,000 and you sell it, it was your primary residence, you sell it for $400,000, you don't owe capital gains taxes on that $200,000 gain. If you're married, you can go up to a $500,000 gain. And if you get over that $500,000, you pay taxes on only the amount over. But again, we go back to that depreciation recapture and the increased basis due to home upgrades. Those both still factor in. So it's kind of, if you put in $100,000, that does raise your basis by $100,000. And then you get the capital gains exemptions on primary residence on top of that.
Right. Good stuff.
I think the last thing I want to mention, if you have an ESPP, an employee stock purchase plan, many companies will give you a discount, usually 15% discount from either the first price or the last price in a trading window. So you'll put money in from your paycheck, every paycheck, and then they'll place the trades every 6 months usually, or place the purchases. The taxes related to that 15% discount, short answer, are complex. So like, use a CPA to kind of make sure we account for that, because your basis is technically what you paid for it, but you owe taxes on the discount. That's kind of the basic idea. So if any gains or losses apply to that purchase price, you know what? I'd have to double check that. That's one like complex. I want to make sure I'm getting that part right. But yeah, I'll put something in the show notes about ESPP basis. We know that your basis, and you owe taxes on that discount, even though you purchase stock below the current price. So maybe you don't owe, maybe the taxes is what the price is above the discount. Yeah, I save this for last and I'm screwing it up.
Well, I think the important thing to realize with a lot of this stuff is, you know, maybe previous to hearing these conversations, it might be a lot of unknowns, but hopefully, at least by listening to this conversation, you'll have more known unknowns.
Yes, than unknowns.
So at least you're aware that there's something that you might need to think about more in depth about some of this stuff if and when they do come up.
So I think there's definitely, that's now a known unknown. I'm pretty sure the cost basis is reported as after the discount. But you still have to make sure that if you, I think that's what it was. It was the 1099 shows the lower price, shows it after the discount, because that actually was the purchase price. But because you're paying taxes on that discount, you can adjust your basis based on the fact that there was a discount. It's because the IRS kind of agrees that you don't have to be double taxed on that 15% discount in both income taxes and in gains when you sell. But kind of, again, custodians will kind of only report that lower value. So yeah, make sure you, it's now a known unknown that you can make sure to figure out if you have ESPP shares, make sure the base is reported correctly, make sure you're getting that discount, and make sure that you're not double paying taxes on that discount.
All right.
Okay. I think that was a lot. This one kind of felt all over the place. Last week felt a little more organized.
A little bit. It's kind of a catch-all, and you know, the horse has to die at some point.
I like that. Okay, we've beat the dead horse sufficiently. We've used a lot of different tools, came at it from a lot of different angles, and we're ready to move on. So thank you for the conversation today, Trishul.
All right. Well, good stuff, Aaron. And I enjoyed the conversation as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening. If you're enjoying these conversations, do spread the word. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.